Let me put it this way, Mr. Raymer. The 9000 series is the most reliable computer ever made. No 9000 computer has ever made a mistake or distorted information. We are all, by any practical definition of the words, foolproof and incapable of error.
Fred and Jeff and John are the three-horse men. They never get along, they're the three-horse men. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three-horse men. Ride, horsemen, ride!
And good day, folks, and here we are back as promised with one of our first return visits to the world of podcasting. As many of you probably have noticed, it's 50 years since we first landed on the moon with Apollo 11, which means that we're only a year late for the 50th anniversary of 2001, and that's been on my mind a lot lately, so I thought I would get together with Jeff today and talk a little bit about 2001. Have you ever seen 2001, Jeff?
Oh, yeah, a few times.
What was your... when did you see it first?
I want to say I was probably 14, and they showed it at one of the first conventions that I went to. It was called Sci-Fi Happening. It was held at the Springfield Science Museum, which is now partially turned over to the Dr. Seuss Museum at the Quadrangle in Springfield. And we had a few authors there, and the movie track was pretty much everything that they showed at conventions back then. This Island Earth, Forbidden Planet, Day the Earth Stood Still, and 2001, mm-hmm. Which at the time was really the only place you could see it. I remember when NBC first aired it, but I don't remember the exact date. And then when VHS came out, I bought it on VHS. I think I still have that VHS somewhere. And have seen it many, many times on a number of platforms. Most recently, probably about just under a year ago. I want to say it was the end of last spring. Like Showtime Beyond or someone like that managed to get a hold of it, and they aired it, so I watched it again.
Well, I have to confess, my first viewing was around the time that it came out.
Mm.
So I did get to see it on the big screen in Cinerama, in a theater which later I don't think was Cinerama, but it was the same theater where I saw Star Wars on opening day, mm-hmm. in the same theater and the same showing as a certain science fiction author, Brian Daley,
mm.
who later went on to write the Han Solo trilogy.
Yeah.
For those of you who remember that particular work of media tie-in. So since then, I've, of course, saw it several times in the theater. We bought our first TV because it was being shown on, I think it was WPIX, shortly after we got married. We bought our first VCR, and that was the first tape I bought. When we bought the DVD player, it was the first DVD I bought. And when we bought the Blu-ray player, it was the first Blu-ray I bought. So I've seen it a few times, and I've read the book who knows how many times, and in the show notes I will put my personal obituary of Arthur C. Clarke and how much he has affected me over the years, because I mean, people talk about favorite authors. I think Clarke has to be my favorite author still.
Mm-hmm.
For many reasons, the vision, the positivism, the ability of writing a short book filled with more ideas per page than most authors of these big bricks we get these days manage to fit into their bricks. So the reason I wanted to talk about this was that I was reading a book called Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece by Michael Benson.
Mm-hmm.
And you may or may not be familiar with some of the other books I'll talk about tonight. But for example, Jerome Eagle's classic, The Making of Kubrick's 2001, and any one of three editions of a making of book by a guy named Piers Bisani.
Mm-hmm.
So Benson, I mean, if you read it, a lot of the stuff is very familiar. But then you come across these Easter eggs, like how Keir Dulay came up with the whole thing essentially on his own of how to get he wasn't happy with how the whole story was going with Hal, so he came up with an idea which basically partly led to the whole Pod Bay scene where he and Poole and Bowman are inside the pod plotting how to take down Hal. And then, but they had a problem. The story goes on to tell how they had a problem of, well, how does Hal find out? And just somebody happened to be walking in when this was being discussed and said, well, have him read the lips, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's weird stories like that. I mean, then you read, like, tidbits, like, you remember the name Brian Johnson?
Mm-hmm.
Did special effects for Thunderbirds, UFO,
yep.
Space 1999. I mean, mm-hmm. he was a crewman on the stage at that time. And he came up with, for example, one of the methods of projecting data. I mean, Douglas Trumbull came up with all this film that became the screens in the Discovery, you know, all the various systems readouts that
yep.
Hal projected. And Brian Johnson came up with the way of projecting it. And if you know what that set was like, it was a centrifuge. So they literally had all these motion picture projectors set up to either project forwards or backwards, depending on the orientation of the projector at the time, clamped to the outside of this huge centrifuge that would rotate so that they could film the people on, like, the top and bottom of the centrifuge. Like, there's one scene where the one crewman comes down a set of stairs, and the other crewman is at the table eating at the opposite end of the wheel. He
mm-hmm.
was strapped in upside down. And this guy, I learned in this book, I mean, there were three people on the stage crew or the movie crew that were afraid of flying, including Kubrick and the two stars. So you had these three people that were afraid of flying, one of which is strapped in upside down in a centrifuge. Where at another point, not only did Marvin Minsky, when he was visiting set once, almost got killed by a hammer, but there was also a crewman who fell and broke his back at one point. So that's not an easy set. So you got a guy strapped in upside down, and it's just amazing, some of these stories in this book. So this has led me then to, of course, talking about, you know, looking at the Jerome Agel book, and if people aren't familiar with Jerome Agel, he did a lot of media stuff, like a book on Marshall McLuhan. He did a book with book or two with Carl Sagan, and his book, The Making of Kubrick's 2001, is more a collection of notes and news stories and anecdotes, and it's just this amazing little document that for years and years was the only thing that existed as far as how 2001 was made. Then Clark came out with a book called The Lost Worlds of 2001, and that was like his log of the involvement. Then you've got the Pizzoni books and the best version of that. If you don't mind laying out about $60, The Making of Stanley Kubrick's 2001 Space Odyssey by Pizzoni, Bizony, is an amazing book with all these fold-out panels of pre-production art that will just blow your mind.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've been on a bit of a binge, and then that led me to a biography of Clark, Neil McAleer, Arthur C. Clarke, Odyssey of a Visionary. And Clark, of course, there's a lot that we know about him. There's a lot we don't know about him. There's a lot that keeps, you know, circling around, which may or may not be true. So this biography's kind of evolved over the years. This is, I think, the third or fourth version of it. And it's now, you know, openly known that Clark was gay, was bisexual. There's a lot intimated as to how far this went. His partner in filmmaking and diving, Mike Wilson, had an interesting background. The stuff in here about Clark and Kubrick and how they got along together is really interesting. The only disappointment with this book is, I mean, I don't know how you feel about biographies of authors, but I like to have something about the writing process. And that was one thing, I don't know if you read the autobiography that Jack Vance came out with shortly before he died, but the biggest disappointment about that book was that he didn't write about writing. He just wrote about, you know, his adventures as a merchant marine, things like that. And he was like, come on, Jack, talk about the writing, talk about the writing. Never got to it. So this book is a bit of a disappointment as well, because it does talk on occasion about Clark's writing, but it's more a description of whatever book he was working on. There's very little about his inner process, so that's a bit of a disappointment. So, now I'll put several other things in the show notes, including a couple of my blog posts over the years about Clark, because the one thing that his books also always did to me was whenever he did an afterword or acknowledgments, he would mention other books, and that would lead me to buy more books. For example, in The Ghost from the Grand Banks, that's where I learned about fractals and ended up buying a book by Benoit Mandelbrot about fractals. And in Imperial Earth, he talked about pentominoes, which are geometrical shapes made up of five squares, and pentominoes actually were in 2001 at one point in the scene that's cut out, a game that one of the astronauts plays. So the stuff about pentominoes in there has led to a multi-decade fascination by me of that kind of puzzle. So Clark's books were always good for, you know, not only what were in it, but afterwards, where they would lead you. So, that's me and Clark in 2001.
No, I was a big Clark reader for a chunk of the 70s. I even remember when he said Fountains of Paradise was going to be his last book. Ha! That turned out well. 2001, last year, I got to somebody I met, had a copy of the Taschen book, the Taschen art book, and I spent about an hour flipping through it, and it had all those pages from the Howard Johnson's Menu, and it had that wonderful cutaway of the front module of the Discovery that we just sat there and debated about for far too much time. And talked about the significance of the monolith and talked about the sequels that were published. But one of the other things that I remember distinctly was shortly after I saw the movie, it was a few years after I saw the movie, was when Marvel put out the big oversized Jack Kirby comic adaptation.
Oh, Lordy, yes.
Which was confusing, to say the least, and that was followed up with a very short-lived regular series where Kirby tried to expand on the monolith myth with mixed success. And Machine Man from that from that series ended up becoming part of the Marvel Universe, one of many licensed properties that ended up being, you know, part and parcel to the universe. Rom the Space Knight, Godzilla, Transformers, any number of properties that made their little sidelong appearances in Marvel Comics. One of the things that always impacted me regarding Clark, though, was reading so much of his short fiction in the assorted collections. I mean, I didn't know anybody who didn't have a copy of 9 Million Names of God on their bookshelves back then, and treating it almost like, you know, Led Zeppelin 4 of short story collections, where you just go through and talk about your favorite story and the impact that it had. And there was somebody who was talking on the radio right after Douglas Rain died last year, talking about how well Hal was a predictor of of AI, and they were trying to sort of draw this lineage between HAL and personal assistants like Siri. And the dissenting view was saying, no, it was more along the lines of, you know, the big algorithms that we have that are, you know, managing big data and taking all this information that's flowing in and hammering into some recognizable shape, and that trying to compare HAL to things like the Internet of Things isn't really an honest comparison. It's much more of a raw brute force processing of data.
Right.
And I thought it was a fairly interesting conversation. I think it was on NPR. I was hearing this when it was happening.
There was a two-part episode this year on This American Life on 2001. No, I'm sorry, Studio 360, I think it was. I'll look for that, and I'll put up links to that, whichever show it was. But they talked a lot about HAL and stuff in there. This was back in, the beginning of May, a two-part episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you ever saw it, but many years ago, on HAL's birthday, or date of birth, roughly,
yep.
I think the guy was David Stork, maybe, edited a collection of nonfiction about HAL. You know, and various computer scientists reflecting on what HAL was like and what we had now and what we might get. So I'll have to take that up and reread that again. It's interesting, this Benson thing, and also the Jerome Agel book remind me a lot of things. For example, in Jerome Agel's book, I think they had all the transcripts in one version of the film. Kubrick had like a black and white film in front, which was basically a documentary trying to prove that this stuff really wasn't all that far out.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the amusing things in the Benson book is they tried to get, you know, Sagan to do some stuff, but Sagan wanted editorial control and wanted a fee based on the percentage of the profits of the film and all this other stuff. So Kubrick finally said, nah, you know, we'll find some other scientists.
So.
And then the one thing that keeps tantalizing us, I don't know if you've heard of this, is that Kubrick cut a bunch of stuff out of the film, like roughly, say, 15, 17 minutes. And I think it was less than 5 years ago, Douglas Trumbull, who did a lot of the special effects on the film, said, oh yeah, I found that missing footage. And I think he was going to show it at some sort of conference, but it never happened. So I don't know whether the Kubrick estate put the kibosh on that or what.
Hmm.
But I'd love to see some of that missing film. Because now and then you see pictures. You see pictures, for example, in one of the books of the playground in Clavius Base.
Yeah.
Where the kids are painting and stuff. And you see other pictures of, there's like a promotional picture of the stewardess using this briefcase with the phone and the printer and, you know, the businessman's workstation of the future or whatever.
Mm-hmm. So,
but I'd love to know if any of all this footage exists. Because apparently when Frank Poole gets crushed by HAL, when HAL takes over the pod, mm-hmm. there's supposed to be a rather bloody scene or where he's dying, so which was cut.
Wow.
So I wonder if that still exists.
That I was not aware of.
Yeah, I think, I'm trying to remember if it's kind of hinted at in the movie with what's left in that. I mean, you do see the scene where he's like tumbling away and he's trying to put the hose back in.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I do believe that there's a scene where he's like dying, which was cut. So that's hinted at in one of the books I've read. So I'd love to know if that still exists.
The other thing that I always remember when I think of 2001 that always makes me smile was in 1984, the last season of SCTV did this ridiculous parody called 2009, Jupiter and Beyond. which basically cast Ernest Borgnine and Simon and Garfunkel as astronauts on the Discovery. And basically, it's a parody of both Catwoman on the Moon and Queen of Outer Space.
Oh, God.
And sort of treating it like the Abbott and Costello Go to Mars movie, you know, with the, you know, with all the classic slapstick comedy stuff, the character in the mirror with the monster and the doors on either side of the hallway and the characters running back and forth, and just the whole idea of taking 2001 and turning it into a slapstick comedy for the sake of entertainment purposes. It was pretty funny. And of course this was years before, you know, 2010 came out. And,
right.
And just the idea that they would take a movie that was that old and, you know, parody it. I mean, they had done The Godfather and they had done Billy Jack and they had done a few other films, but really, really reaching back into the SF canon and making a parody out of it.
I mean, my dread is that, who, for example, the guy that redid Psycho scene for scene.
Yeah.
My dread has always been that someone will do that to 2001. And
well, I did a page. I'll put the link up. I did a page called Hollywood Remakes 2001 a few years back, which was a little seven-frame comedy bit, which is what I thought modern Hollywood mentality would do if they were given the chance to play with those characters.
Well, did you ever see the 2001 trailer recut version?
I don't know if I have.
I'll have to find it. It's on YouTube. It's this basically if Michael Bay or something like that were to do 2001, the trailer would be, and it's all this very, very dramatic music and shortcuts, and no scene looks longer than 10 seconds, and you know, you just can't tell what's going on, and it's very, very, right. Very, very, very fast moving, and it's very hilarious. If you've seen the movie, you know, yeah. It doesn't move that fast.
Right. The other thing is, there was a quite a bit of talk at the time, I remember this, when Space 1999 came out, about how so much of the aesthetic in Moonbase and so much of the hardware, like the Eagle hangars and the little rovers and even the gentle curves of the desks and the lighting fixtures and the way the doors were situated and marked, and not just that, but all the various incidental signage that you saw everywhere, how that was directly inspired by 2001, how Gerry Anderson wanted to have a very utilitarian feel to it, which he thought 2001 had done
right.
quite a good job with.
Well, even UFO, the very, very similar feel in Moonbase and Skydiver and things mm-hmm. like that. Yep, definitely.
Yes, but 2001 never made as good use of Nehru jackets as they did on UFO.
Well,
so.
You know, no one, not even the Beatles made as good use of Nehru jackets as UFO did.
Yeah, I'm still mad the future never brought that around, so.
Yep. Well, it's not too late.
No, it isn't.
Well, it's been good talking about 2001.
Yeah.
2010.
I think I may have to go, 2061. May have to go watch it again.
Definitely on my plate once I get through a few more books. So we'll speak to you again soon, folks. Who knows what we'll bring to you next. See you later.
Take care.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.